You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to my couch here on LA Talk Radio. You can watch us right here on our Facebook page and everywhere else. You can see us on Twitter, YouTube, and I'm going to put it out there where you can watch our rerun as well on my webpage here at latalkradio.com. Of course, we're airing simultaneously on the radio all over the world. And thank y'all for joining me, no matter where you're at. It's really my pleasure to introduce my guest today, which I'm going to in just a bit. We're talking about a subject that I have rarely dealt with. I've experienced it in my own life, not because I'm a comedian particularly, but I've worked with comedians before in certain situations. But, you know, I loved this subject. When my special guest PR people talked to me about it, I went, oh my gosh, I've got to have this guy on, because he is the author of an amazing book. And once you get it and start reading it and start hearing the stories that he's going to share with you today, you're going to want to get the book and find out more about what my special guest is going to share with you. You know, there may be a lot of worse things for comedians or comedy actors to worry about than having a string of jokes that bomb, right? I mean, can you imagine that horrifying feeling? And I'm sure a lot of comedians who are superstars now started out in small little clubs and whatever, trying out their style and their jokes on people and the silence, you know, the bombing, all that. But today we're going behind the stage and the sets of famous comedians. We're going to find out what really happened to them and their shows when they had to go to court, behind the scenes. My special guest is going to be talking about some of those famous comedians and the cases and what they had to deal with in serious legal issues, and what perhaps details that their attorneys and their agents and managers or whoever might have missed to try and keep them out of the courtroom. But nope, they're in. And my special guest is going to share that with you. He's got a new book out. It's called Comedy Goes to Court: When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting. Carl Unebu, thank you so much for coming to the show today. It's great to have you.
Thanks a lot, Michelle. It's my honor to be here.
Oh, what a fun book. I just couldn't put it down because you... who mentioned you mentioned in your book and say, oh my gosh, I have to find out more. But once you start reading, you really get into it. Let me share with people who you are, Carl. I think you're considered, and from what I read, the foremost authority on comedy and the law. And you've written an entire book here that we're going to be talking about to help comedians and just the general public become aware of what's going on legally behind the scenes and ways that they can avert lawsuits and legal entanglements. Of course, Carl is a new... subsequently the writer of a highly read blog called Oh Carl's Law, focusing on the intersection between comedy and law. You were a reporter at The Real Deal magazine before taking on the editorship of ComedyBeat.com. His articles have appeared in Reuters, Forum Journal, World Policy Magazine, New York Review of Magazines, on and on. City Limits, the new New York County Lawyer. And also you've hosted the industry forum Comedy Dialogue, a quarterly series held in Manhattan's Upper West Side, featuring stand-up comedy performances, panel discussions involving some of the comedy's industry best and brightest talents. And again, today we're talking about your book, Carl. Comedy Goes to Court: When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting. What I am so interested in is, what was it that really made you want to be drawn to comedy artists and comedy and get into law about their contracts?
Yeah, so thank you very much. And again, the title of the book, comedy goes to court, when people stop laughing and start fighting. So this book began his journey as a blog.
Yeah.
And the blog itself began as some kind of something on the side of Comedy Beat, the website that we covered comedy on.
Right.
Like a blog role on the side.
Uh-huh.
And this was the blog that I wrote as part of that blog role. I mean, other reporters and other folks who were working with us had, you know, blog roles too. So this was my blog role on the site. And then, you know, being a lawyer, I noticed the patterns of comedians, you know, having these issues with the law. I mean, when we started Comedy Beat, I went out there to just fun and games of comedy. I discovered this other thing that was there, like something of a not so secret thing. It was there, but nobody was talking about it, which is that comedians were having lots of lawsuits following them, you know, in their work and things of that nature. I mean, these lawsuits became sort of like a cost of doing business in comedy, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And in terms of like when it started, I noticed that it started like sometime around 2000 until the present time. So it was sort of like a new trend.
Yes.
And so it naturally caught my attention. So I decided to, like, you know, be blogging about those kinds of issues, comedians who got sued or who got in trouble with the law, either with their fans or business partners or even the government or even family members, if you believe that. So, you know, so I started to write that blog and cover those issues. And then it took on a life of its own because of the way I was writing about the comedians and the problems they had. Because prior to that time, the blogs that people were writing were either maybe entertainment law blogs, you know, where lawyers were talking about entertainment law, you know, writing them like lawyers, lots of citations and legal mumbo jumbo and all that. Or the sites or the blogs simply covered comedy, you know, like comedy commentary. But none of these platforms, you know, none of these platforms, you know, was covering the intersection of comedy and the law. And that was where I came in. And that was what my readers found very refreshing, because for the first time, they saw some place where these two things were being discussed in the same stream.
Right. And
even more important to them was the language. It was written in very, you know, easy read, conversational language. You know, the sort of stuff that they would see in, like, People magazine or, like, you know, the world famous Page Six of the New York Post. So it was that kind of easy read, conversational type style of writing. And so that was what fascinated them about it. So the commentary, the responses I got back from them really encouraged me to keep going, because, you know, when I started writing that, I didn't even know that it could be done, because it had never been done before.
It hasn't. No, it's something really new. That's what I believe.
So the gratitude of my readers made me keep going. So I sort of like figured, okay, actually, maybe there's something here. So I kept going. And, you know, they kept giving me feedback. Sometimes they suggested some, maybe even topics to address, you know. So it took on a life of its own. And long story short, eventually, it led to a book. But I didn't set out to write the book at all. When I started the blog, I had no idea that I would ever even, like, end up writing a book.
Yes, exactly. But you have so much background. You know, my goodness, Comedy Beat and everything you've done, the O'Carroll's Law, you know, all the things that you've been involved with for years, you know, talking about comedians. And are you a funny guy, Carl?
Oh, I don't pretend to be a funny guy, because, you know, if I were as funny as a comedian, I would actually be a comedian, but, you know.
That's right. There you go. Exactly. So the way the book is, you know, sort of rolled out is each chapter is sort of a case study in a way, but it's offered in layman's terms, like you said, Carl, in what the law allows, what comedians should know before, committing to agreements or content that could dangerously toe the line for them. And comedians should know probably a little bit more about the, you know, contracts they sign before committing to agreements. And this is what you're talking about in all these different instances. So talking about hashing out the deal for comedy jobs, you suggest that most entertainers don't fully appreciate that many of the problems that come up in the course of their work could have been avoided, right? If they had people who were really on it. And really knew what they were. And you know, you think about actors, actresses, stage people, commercial people who but sometimes comedians kind of go the wayside. You don't think about that, but my gosh, look at all the famous comedians you talk about.
Yep.
You know, in
yep.
your book. Yep. So you're gonna share with us, if it's cool, some of these famous comedians' cases and sort of the outcomes and how they, and I hate to say it, how their people messed up.
Yeah,
you know, actors, comedians, no. they trust in their attorneys. They trust in their teams to really get into the fine print or write the deals for them. So one of my favorite comedians I want to talk about first, if it's okay with you, is Dave Chappelle. I love him. Okay.
Oh.
I love that man. He's the... Anyway, in 2004, you write about his situation.
Right.
Yeah, he was really rocking it with the comedy scene. I mean, I love his Dave Chappelle show. You just never missed it, always recorded it. Comedy Central wanted a piece of him, you talk about, right? So
yeah.
can you elaborate what was going on? We heard about it in the news, but we didn't know the details, but you have all the details, Carl.
Yeah, so, yeah, that Chappelle case was, you know, one of the cases that I thought was, you know, one of the cases that I found interesting. And, you know, people pick up on that a lot. Now, it was this deal that, I mean, I have in the section of the book dealing with making a contract for comedy work. And I guess the point there is that the time to getting a lawyer is at the very beginning.
Right.
To get you through... to get you to safely navigate, you know, the territory. Because the folks you work with, the networks, usually they have tons of lawyers working for them.
Yeah.
You better have a good lawyer looking over the document and watching your back. Anyway, this case was, so he had this contract, about $50 million worth contract work, you know, so somewhere mid-season, this was at around 2005 or so. So somewhere mid-season through this contract, he bailed on the contract. He wasn't showing up. And then Comedy Central, you know, people were wondering, hey, where is Dave Chappelle? Where is this guy? I mean, but his show was very, like, popular. Folks loved the sketches.
Wow.
And they were like, you know, people were fascinated by the sketches and stuff.
Right.
Now, so he left, went on the lam, went to, you know, South Africa. That was where he ended up. You know, and then folks were like, okay, so what happened here? He said, some argument developed between himself and Comedy Central.
Yeah.
He left the show. He wouldn't continue the production of the remaining episodes, you know, on the season. And then Comedy Central wanted him back, and he said no. So there was that standoff. Now, it turned out, the way Chappelle explained it, you know, that there were these creative differences.
Yeah.
You know, something that wasn't negotiated at the very beginning. In other words, because, I mean, look, if the show is doing very well on a particular format,
right?
Are you able to change it around? Let's say the network loves it because it's bringing in the dough. The format is bringing in the dough, but maybe you feel creatively stifled and you want to, like, maybe change direction.
Right.
But then it comes into conflict with the network's desire to keep this thing going. You know, as they say, if it end broke, why fix it?
Yeah. Exactly.
So that tension could arise over creative differences. And that was what happened here. So Chappelle left. He said that he was feeling creatively stifled, that there was the particular episode, something, the Pixie episode, where he said he saw, he was shocked to notice that some people were actually laughing at him instead of with him. And he felt so embarrassed. And then he just, for some reason, he couldn't continue with the show unless creative changes were made. And now Comedy Central didn't want to adhere. We didn't want to, like, concede to any of those creative differences that he was suggesting, because, you know, the format that existed was doing very well, was so popular with people, was bringing in the dough. But then that was the format that made Dave Chappelle feel terribly uncomfortable. He felt being used. He felt like people were laughing at him instead of with him. So, yeah, he just, yeah, he sort of felt dehumanized continuing this. So despite the money, the big money, the big pot of gold that was available in this contract, he was so, like, alienated that he left, left the money behind. And then part of the problem was, part of the disagreement was, okay, apart from creative differences, whether you can make a creative turn in a different direction, which was obviously part of his deal, because they locked him into what was there. They sort of painted him into a corner. Now, then there was also this dispute over the remaining episodes that he said, because he was saying, but he didn't like the episodes, the way they were going, and the direction of them, so he didn't want to continue. But there were some unreleased episodes that were still, like, you know, in storage. So he didn't want those episodes released because, again, they reminded him of the things he didn't like about the show. Now, the question was, could he force them to not release them? Or, I mean, are they obligated not to release them if he said not to do so? Well, apparently, the contract was silent on that kind of situation. So they, again, contrary to his wishes, after the contract ended, you know, they released the episode anyway, after he walked away.
Yeah.
So over his objections, they released the episode. So, I mean, and he couldn't do anything about it because, you know, the contract was silent on that kind of thing. But again, the point I was making with that particular case is, you know, at the very beginning, try to eliminate every, well, obviously, no human being can predict every possibility of how human interactions could go in the future. But, you know, there are some serious, there are some main points, you know, that are very predictable.
Sure.
And they tend to recur. They tend to recur in contracts, you know, what to do with the episodes that have not been finished, or negotiating a creative control. Creative control is very important. It's something, if you're somebody who is in the creative industries, this is something you want to pay attention to, because, you know, as Dave Chappelle said, comedy is a place of extremes. You know, they either want you to go all the way here or all the way there.
Right.
And he was seeking a middle ground where he could feel, you know, creatively comfortable and emotionally okay. But that wasn't the situation he faced. So
right.
So it wasn't a good deal that he made, and he paid the price for it.
That's too bad. I love the show, excuse me, but I understand, you know, I understand working with a network.
Right.
You know, and yeah, his comedy's outrageous, and he wanted to be more creative with it, but NBC was kind of curbing his style a little bit. You know? So it must have been tough, you know. By the way, guys, in case you just tuned in, you're here on the couch, and my special guest is attorney Carl Unebo. He's the author of an amazing book. It's called Comedy Goes to Court, When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting. And it's wonderful in explaining all of these different cases and what happens specifically with comedians and, you know, their deals that went bad, or when they had to deal with a particular network or production company, and the fights and millions of dollars that they or the particular companies lost. It's a really interesting book, and I think you all will really be into it. We'll tell you how you can get the book. Well, everywhere, Amazon, brick-and-mortar stores, everywhere. Just Google it. Comedy Goes to Court, When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting.
It looks like...
There it is. I got the PDF copy.
Oh, wonderful.
So there it is. Yeah, please hold that up occasionally for us, because, it was a great book, and I appreciate it so much. Really good. Some of the other cases that you discuss are really interesting as well, Carl. Specifically, I remember rooting for Conan O'Brien, you know, when he walked away with about $30 million. He was fighting with NBC too.
Yeah.
You know, can you talk about sort of what happened there? So he was, I mean, he should have walked away with more probably, the way they treated him, but What happened to him in that particular case?
Yeah, he was, you know, again, it's part of this thing about having enough imagination when you deal with the networks and things, because so many things could happen. The networks, they tend to focus on their financial interests, the bottom line. And whatever happens to your career or whatever is a different thing altogether. But this was a case where he, you know, he signed up for, he took over the Late Show, and then they put him on a particular slot, you know, late night.
Right.
It's like 11:35 p.m. until, you know, he sheds over into. Right. So he was there, and then he replaced Jay Leno. And then Leno went to, like, the other show at a different schedule, I think 10 o'clock. But then people started to, like, say, well.
Right. You know, that's right.
Yeah, people started to like say, well, Leno is the big guy here in the network, you know. He was the competition at the 10 p.m. slot. You know, Leno wasn't doing so well there. They felt that his niche was at 11:35 p.m. slot. But that was the slot that Conan had at the time.
Yeah.
And then, so after the bosses looked at things and they figured, well, you know, look, we are better. Leno is a bigger name. They thought they made a mistake to have shuffled Leno out of that slot, that it wasn't the best use of that time and Leno's talents and things. So Paul O'Brien, you know, they decided that it was better for them to knock him off that perch and hand it to Leno. And then they tried to, like, move him to a slot beyond midnight, 12:35 or something like that.
And it was still the Tonight Show or the...
Right, But, you know, he figured, well, look, you know, if it's the late night show, if it's not at that particular hour, you know, I'm not going to do it. It's not helping me. Well, unfortunately for him, he did not have it in his contract to insist on that particular slot. You know, it was like NBC could move him back and forth. And that's exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then there was this issue about, you know, whether he could work for some other company, while if he wasn't working for them, they were able to, like, enforce the non-compete against him, except that, you know, after he left that deal, they didn't care too much anymore, because their goal was to simply
get
Leno back in that slot. And that was what happened.
Well, you know what? He won the case, and pretty much, and good.
Yeah,
he
got a lot of money. But
And you know, they did. They promised him a lot, and then they buried him in the late slot. And I thought he was wonderful. I really liked him, I love Jay Leno. But
I think you know, in fairness to them, well, look, I'm not one of their executives, but ultimately, Leno was a better use of that time slot for them in terms of, like, ratings and fans. So I think that was what they calculated, and they figured, you know, this guy, they could hurt O'Brien to advance their own economic interest. And they did that. Unfortunately, O'Brien didn't have the kind of contract with them that would have prevented them from doing that. So
Wow. Thanks for sharing that story.
Yeah, but one case that comes up a lot,
people
talk to me about this a lot when it comes to hashing out the deal. It's like, what should they do? How should they go about making these deals?
Right.
Yeah, usually they talk to me a lot about the Howard Stern show that I have in this book.
Yes.
The fight between Howard Stern and Sirius XM.
Yeah.
And that really gives you a sense of, you know, why it's so important that you put things inside your contract if you want to claim them. You know, like, for instance, you know, if I said I'll give you $1 million in 5 years if you come up with, like, 10 children.
Right.
So 5 years' time comes up, and you bring 10 children.
Right.
Well, five of them are adopted instead of natural born. Well, are you still entitled to the 1 million? Even though five of the 10, you know, were adopted instead of natural born. So that kind of thing.
Right.
Those are the kinds of things you have to deal with. Like, it happened in the Howard Stern case. You know, the idea was that if he brought in a certain number of subscribers at the time that his contract was up for renewal, that he would get a certain bonus, a big payment. Well, at the time he made his contract, it was still serious.
Uh-huh. It was, yeah.
It was Sirius. It wasn't Sirius XM. XM came later.
Right.
So after they after the contract, then Sirius merged with XM. So it became Sirius XM.
Right.
Now XM brought its own subscribers, additional subscribers that were additional to separate from the ones Howard brought in.
Sure, he had a great audience. Huge.
Right. Howard had a great audience. Yeah. It was, you know, things were growing organically. But then when the merger happened, the other side, XM brought in so many more subscribers.
Right.
So the subscriber numbers grew.
Right.
And then Howard, the subscriber numbers hit that magic number.
Yes.
And then Howard said, well, okay, so here we are at the renewal. I was promised that if I get this kind of number, I would, you know, get this bonus. Now, XM said, the company said, no, Howard, look, you know, these people who came in here, they didn't come in because of anything you did. The increased numbers came in simply because of the merger, not because of anything you did, you know, during the time under consideration. So if you wanted to insist on this, you should have written it into the contract that if you have this kind of
number,
no matter how the number came in, whether through merger or through organic growth under you, that you'll be entitled to this bonus. So, yeah. And that was what the court told him. Said, look, you know, you can't, you know, this people didn't come in through anything you did. They came in simply through the merger. If you would have wanted to get this money anyway, then you could have, you should have put it into the contract that, you know, no matter what happens, no matter how the numbers came in, that you get this bonus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like the rule.
Sirius said they did because they did the merger, it's not because of your talent.
Exactly.
You know, Howard Stern, you know, and I was surprised that it was dismissed, right?
The court, you know, dismissed. Yeah, he lost.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the lesson there that, you know, well, you know, if you want this kind of money, put this things in the contract. You know, this was a foreseeable thing that the number could increase for other reasons. Well, if you want to get paid, when you hit that magic number, then you have to like specify for payment upon that number being reached. So, yeah.
That's really makes a lot of sense. Listen, in case you just chimed in here, I'm speaking with an amazing man. He's a New York attorney, Carl Unebu. He is the author of the book, Comedy Goes to Court. There it is, When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting.
Yep.
And it's all about what has gone down behind the scenes between many famous comedians. You get the real deal story in this one because Carl has been, you know, in the journalistic community forever. You know, he has been on so many particular newspapers. Also, he was the editor of Comedy Beat website, subsequently the writer, highly read blog, Carl Saw. Didn't you go to Paris? You worked in Paris also.
Yeah, I was a law clerk at the International Court of Arbitration.
Interesting.
It was a great time in Paris at the law.
Parlez vous français? Yeah, sir. You have to learn that, right? If you're going to live there, that's awesome. How fun! You've done so many things, Carl, and I love your book. It's really informative about what really happened behind the scenes. And I know you're a serious attorney, but you're also a cool, funny guy because of the way you write and the stories, and also the way you lay it out in the chapters as to what happened and why things did not really go the right way for some of these comedians and why it didn't go well for some of the studios, production companies and syndication companies. I remember back in 2009, I was working for CBS Radio and right across the hall that I was doing news in the morning here in Los Angeles, right across the hall was Adam Carolla and his crew. They had a show, the Adam Carolla Show.
Okay.
And it was sort of unexpectedly canceled by CBS. And I would, we were across the glass, you know, waving and making faces and all that. And, you know, I usually go into the kitchen during breaks or after the show and kibitz a little bit with his crew and him and all that. And I remember, I think, meeting his longtime friend, Donnie Mizrahi.
Okay.
a couple of times, you know.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
I have them in this book.
They were really close. They were really good friends. So can you talk a little bit more about what happened between them and how that went down? And I mean, I was there at CVS and there was talk, you know, how people gossip in the halls of like, oh, we're going to, you know, the show's, you know, it doesn't meet CBS's standards.
Right.
And I remember at one time, you know, I'd wave or whatever, we'd walk by the glass and they'd But what would happen is after a while, and I think they did this because the top brass would come in. You know, they were just downstairs a little bit. We were upstairs. What they did is they covered the glass after a while. They didn't want people peeking in or watching, and they just were feeling, I could get that they were feeling uncomfortable. So what went down there that you can elaborate on?
Yeah, you know, it was, again, one of these situations where you have people making contracts at a time, like, you know, you didn't know how successful the venture might become. And then you might tend to not, you know, cross all your T's and dot all your I's. And So that was sort of what happened. You know, where he and Donny Misraji, they had this deal where after Akarola was fired from CBS, he then launched this Akarola show, you know, a podcast this time. So he decided to like join up with his buddy, Donny. So Corolla was going to become like, you know, the talent. And then Donny was going to become like the guy who handled the technical aspects of things and maybe even threw in some money or something like that. So now, in the law, that was like a partnership.
Right.
Even though they didn't have a particular agreement where they had a partnership. And that's the thing. Now, so they started to operate, and then somewhere down the road, disputes arose about like, and especially after the money started to come in, about, you know, was this a partnership or was this a situation where somebody merely loaned money to another person and it wasn't just a partnership, he could repair the money. The implication is, if it's a partnership, then you two have equal shares.
Right.
But if it's just the money, amount of money you borrowed, then they could simply pay you back the money you put in there.
Right.
And it wouldn't include all the benefits that have come up now since the show has grown, all the bigger money that has accrued. So unless it's a partnership, you wouldn't get a share of the pot of gold coming from the show becoming successful. So that was the issue there. Was it a partnership or was it just somebody who loaned money to somebody else? Well, you know, obviously, the other guy, Donny said it was a partnership. And then Carola said, no, it wasn't a partnership. So that was the issue there.
Yeah.
You know, and then the court ended up saying, yeah, look, you know, the partnership, you two had this deal going. He abandoned something else, opportunities that he was going to pursue just to come in here. Then he contributed equipment and other sorts of things and time and even some other relative of his wife or something, sort of had a part in the operation. So yeah, so it was all those things. So the court looked at it like, well, a partnership is some kind of situation where two people are collaborating, you know, in an enterprise for profit and things. And then they looked at everything together and say, yeah, so from all indications, given the way you guys operated, you know, you were making decisions together, you were contributing things together to make this thing grow, that yeah, we find that this is a partnership. But, you know, very simply, they could have avoided that problem at the very beginning by simply having a contract. You know, say, this is a partnership.
Right.
But again, it didn't happen. But again, the thing is, though, just because he didn't have that maybe foresight to take care of that at the beginning doesn't mean that if disputes arise, that the courts would not make a determination. They'll make a determination.
Right.
If you didn't write things down, they'll probably decide something you might not have expected will be the decision. So that's what happens there.
Right.
Yeah, but that was their situation. Partnership.
They had kind of a falling out, I understand.
Right.
Too bad, you know, really good friends and creative people as well. But
well, you know, when money comes in, you know,
there you go.
So the best ways to protect the friendship is to often shut down clearly.
That's right, exactly. You know, so. I always say, try not to work with a really close friend. You know, when it comes down to making money and businesses and all that, on one hand, you can do really well and get each other. You've known each other, you trust each other. But like you said, Carl, when money comes in, it gets kind of
weird. Yeah, when money comes in, you know.
Yeah, it gets weird. I love that chapter in your book where you talk about welcome to the world of the First Amendment and defamation. I mean, that comedy is all about making fun of themselves, the comedians, but also, you know, the tasteless comedy, you know. Religions and whatever cultures, things like that. So, I mean, let's talk about some of those cases that you have been familiar with, because I mean, most of the comedians I like they can be a little raunchy, they can be very controversial, but you have to like, ooh, sometimes you cringe, they're cringeworthy, and you go, oh no, why did he say that? You know, but or why did she say that? but it's kind of like, funny if you could just let it go to comedy. So where is that line drawn, Carl?
Yeah.
What are some of the cases?
Mm-hmm. You see, first of all, comedians, they for some reason have defined their purpose as, you know, they want to be edgy, they want to be rule breaking, and it kind of helps them build their street cred. You know, if you are edgy and you are like that, and you know, if that's what you do and you're successful taking that path, you know, you become sort of notorious for that, and you know, people like it in a way that you're doing that. So at that point, they have no incentive to be polite. If you're being edgy,
sure.
If you're being edgy and you want to create an edgy reputation, then you cannot at the same time be polite and be respectful of society's little boundaries here and there. You know, they just go where the jokes are. Now there's this thing they call the First Amendment, which, you know, is a big thing here in this country. So comedians, obviously, in my mind, they are the biggest beneficiaries of the First Amendment, because you know, the First Amendment allows you to swing your arms as widely as you can in the free speech, unencumbered by government and things, unlike other countries, which I can get to in a minute. So, but there are lines that are drawn. Like, if you make a speech that could incite people to violence, then you don't have the First Amendment right to do that. Or you make a speech that could involve fighting words, words that could make somebody attack you if you use those words in their presence. Let's say you call somebody the N-word, or you know, you make a joke about gay people. You know, words that could immediately cause people to,
sure.
And those are very few words like that are recognized in that way. And obviously, the bigger one is obscenity. You know,
sure.
If you say things that are obscene, then you know there is no First Amendment protection for that. But before you get to this place where this red line is drawn, it's a very long distance to get to that place, which means that there are so many other things you could do without even like running that red light over there.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem is. Now, so comedians are able to do these things that the First Amendment allows them to do, but which the cancel culture people will not tolerate, the woke ideology. In other words, so the law allows you to do this, First Amendment, but you know, we can't let you do this because you're punching down, and we don't want people punching down in our society. This is just so wrong. No, that kind of, so there is that tension.
Exactly.
In America, it's not enough that the First Amendment protects you. Well, you have to also deal with the court of public opinion, where the council are. And the thing is, the law cannot force people to come and watch your show.
Right.
If you're selling a product, if your comedy is sort of like a product you're selling.
Yep. Right, that's right.
If the public that buys the product, the consumers don't want the product anymore because they feel that this product is tainted by you punching down, by cruelty and everything. So
Sure.
And it becomes a really tense kind of relationship where the law allows you to do this, but the public, the consumers won't buy the product because, you know,
true.
They have been conditioned by political correctness and
that's
they have heightened their sensibility about things. So, yeah, so there's that tension there. And the whole point today is to moderate, to find where the line is, where you can be okay with the law and stay. But in general, though, because of the First Amendment, comedians, you know, they slide away freely if you try to sue them. Like, I have a case with Jerry Seinfeld where he was on the David Letterman show, and he was talking about some woman who sued his wife for plagiarism over some children's cookbook.
Right.
And he was saying something about how she was wacko, you know, she had a three.
Oh, no.
She was somebody with three names, you know. He mentioned Mark David Chapman or James R. Ray, you know, the guy who killed Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
People with those kinds of three names, usually they end up as assassins and things. You know, that's so he made a joke about her and everything. Then she turns around and sues him for defamation. She sues Letterman too and other, you know, people associated with the show. But, you know, Jerry won because, again, the court said, look, this is a comedian. You know, he's on a comedy show. People understood the show to be a humorous thing. Nobody watching that show would have thought that he was describing an actual assassin, you know, that it was just a joke, you know, that if it's not a joke, it was simply his opinion. Yeah. That it wasn't defamation. So she lost.
Right.
But that's like, that's a demonstration of the fact that, you know, it's not easy to win against a comedian when it comes to defamation in this country.
Interesting.
Because,
The
First Amendment and then the joke factor, the opinion factor, you know, so it's just not easy at all. And but then, you know, there are some situations where it is, one other situation I cover in the book, you know, where a comedian could actually, the very rare cases where a comedian could actually be liable for defamation. If you make a false statement of fact.
Right.
A statement of fact is like something you can say that can be proven to be true or not true.
Okay.
If you say rain, if you say that it rained yesterday at 4 p.m., well, it either rained or it didn't. That's a statement of fact. If it rained, then it's a true statement of fact. If it didn't, it's a false statement of fact.
Yes.
So that's kind of where it goes. Now,
interesting.
In Australia, his name is Mick Molloy. So he went on a TV show called Before the Game, and then he made this joke about a woman who was a politician, a member of parliament. Then he made a joke that she had slept with somebody who was on the football team of her husband.
Oh,
her husband was a football coach. And then this comedian alleged that, you know, this politician had slept with one of the players on the husband's team.
Wow.
Well, it turned out it was false. Now, she's using for defamation. And then they tried to say, well, you know, he's a comedian. You know, the show he was
performing
on was
in
humorous context. The court said, this is a statement of fact, which happens to be false.
Yeah.
And it has damaged her reputation. She's a politician, you know. So, it was an attack on a woman's dignity and all that stuff. So, so in that case, those are the rare sorts of situations where you could actually make a comedian liable for defamation. A statement of fact.
That's right. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, what is, because, you know, they are so influential and people will believe it.
Right.
You know, and someone else who I remember, I was reading about Frankie Boyle.
Oh,
the British comedian, you know,
right.
He was known as like the racist, most racist comedian.
Right.
And I remember seeing his stuff, kind of sick. I don't know. I'm sorry, Frankie, but kind of sick jokes, you know,
he does.
Again, you know, so you talk about his, his case. It wasn't more defamation of character. It was just downright offensive and inappropriate. Right.
It was defamation. He sued them for defamation, which is one of those cases that demonstrate to you, like I have it in the second chapter here on the free speech aspect, where one of those cases that show you how British comedy is different from American comedy. In other words, how the First Amendment makes a big difference you know, on either side of the Atlantic. I mean, his case was a case where he sued the Daily Mirror, the newspaper, for defamation, for calling him a racist.
Yeah, right.
The paper had said that he was fired from a show
Wow.
Because of his racist behavior, that he wasn't going to be able to allow back on the show because of his history of racism. Well, so he sues them for defamation, for calling him a racist. I mean, he claims that just because he makes racist jokes doesn't mean that that's what he believes in, that he was just a comedian making those jokes.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that he was a racist. Well,
right.
So eventually the court ended up saying, well, you said that they fired him on this show because of racism, but it wasn't the case. So he brought him from the show to come and say that no, that they did not fire him because of racism, that as a matter of fact, that they were looking forward to him coming back to the show.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting.
Contrary to what the paper had said.
Interesting.
So there were all those issues, and then the court ended up saying, well, look, you have defamed him, you have to pay. So they fined them a lot of money, thousands of pounds to pay.
Yeah. Now,
what if that case would have happened in the US? Could he have won? Very difficult, because you guessed it, the First Amendment. He would have been a public figure.
Right.
And to be a public figure, it's not easy to win a defamation case unless you could prove what they call actual malice. Actual malice, meaning you intentionally said this thing that wasn't true, or you were so reckless.
Right. Right.
You didn't care whether it was true or not. You just said it. So those are the situations where you could be liable for defamation. And it's very difficult to win in that kind
of thing.
Because the standard is very high. Now,
I would imagine.
But in Britain,
I would totally imagine.
In Britain, because there is no First Amendment in Britain.
Right.
There is no public figure.
Right.
There is no public figure. So there is no proof. There is no need to prove actual malice. They handle information the same way that private individuals handle information. In other words, once you make a false statement of fact, you're in for it, But in this country, even if the statement is not true, once it's a public figure, or you're talking about something having to do with the public interest, to win that kind of case, you have to show, this is the actual malice test, you have to show that the person deliberately, willfully told a lie,
right,
or that they were so reckless that they didn't care, that the thing was probably a lie. So it's the highest
right.
It's not the case that just because it's not true,
that is,
you go down for defamation. Yeah. No.
Right. Exactly.
So that's the difference.
Wow. That is, fascinating stories. And can you believe it, Carl? Our time is just about up already.
Oh, wow.
You have so much information and I just love it. I want to share with my viewers and listeners that they can pick up your book anywhere. Go on Amazon, Google it. It's Comedy Goes to Court. When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting, attorney Carl Unebu, considered the foremost authority on comedy and the law. And this book, there it is, boom. It's a great book. We have discussed so many comedians, excuse me, and their cases today. I'm losing my voice because I've been talking all morning. That's a cue. I should just be quiet now. So there are other comedians, famous people who you check out in your book and talk about their cases who we didn't even touch on. But you guys, it's a great read and fascinating. You'll learn a lot about what goes on behind the scenes, and you'll learn a little bit about law as well. So thank you, Carl, for being here on the couch with me today. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Michelle. I appreciate being on, and I hope your audiences will read the book in the spirit it was given to them. Part of the book was written in part to tell them stories, fascinating stories, titillating stories about comedians and their misadventures and their adventures. So the book is a must read for comedians, and it should read for the rest of us who care about the First Amendment.
No, it's really beautifully said. And also many of us who are fascinated with the lives and stories of these comedians.
Lots of stories.
Yeah, love those stories. Carl, you're great. Thank you so much for being here with
me. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye. All right, everybody. Thanks for being here on the couch. As I always say, take care of yourselves first, and then you'll be great for others. And that's the way it works. Be back next week, 11 a.m. on Wednesday, Pacific time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.